The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is the last show of the week, and then we're off to Barbados. You got those tickets, Sam? No? Well, maybe not off to Barbados. We'll be back next week, same time, same station or stream, whatever it is that you use to listen to the program. We appreciate you listening in. Send us those emails so that we can get into that again. Next week, this weekend, by the way, here in the UK, we're offering the Royal Book of Revelation, that little booklet that my father produced a number of years ago. It's the first time that we've offered that one, so we're hoping for a big response to the program. That particular program will be posted today on thetrumpet.com. If it isn't already, it will be soon. Next weekend, we'll be offering the United States and Britain in Prophecy. It's been a few months since we last offered that particular book. So hopefully we can keep that average rising. I think we're at 155 or so per week. That's been the average these last 3 weekends. So let's just keep bumping that up. I want to start today with a clip from yesterday. This is Secretary of State John Kerry. He's in Switzerland, I believe. And these are some comments that he made with respect to how the money that Iran now has, how that money will be used.
Do you believe that any of that $55 billion ends up in the hands of terrorists?
I think that some of it will end up in the hands of the IRGC or of other entities, some of which are labeled terrorist. To some degree, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that every component of that can be prevented, but I can tell you this. Right now, we are not seeing the early delivery of funds going to that kind of endeavor at this point in time. Mm-hmm. I'm sure at some point some of it will, but that has never made the difference in what is happening there. Let me give you an example. The Saudis alone spend $80 billion a year on defense. The entire Gulf state community spends $130 billion a year on defense. Iran spends $15 billion a year on its military activities. So it's so incredibly disproportionate that I believe that working with our Gulf state partners, which we are going to do and which we are upgrading, we have the ability to guarantee that they will be secure, that we will stand by them, even as we look for this potential of a shift.
So there you have it. Some of it, that's from the Secretary of State. Some of it will inevitably end up in the hands of terrorist groups, or groups, as he said, to be specific, groups that are labeled terrorists. He wouldn't even come out himself. The IRGC, of course, that's the Revolutionary Guard. And we talked to you yesterday about how the money's already, it's already being planned to go to these terror groups or these terrorist sponsoring groups. The interviewer there, I think, mentioned the figure $55 billion. That's what Mr. Kerry estimates they're left with after they settle their debts upon receiving the estimated $150 billion earlier in the day. Mr. Kerry said that because of all the internal demands that are on the Iranian government to develop the country, he said, quote, there's no way they can succeed in what they want to do if they are busy funding a lot of terrorism. Now think about that for a second. He's saying the government, he's saying the regime, he's saying the mullahs, the ayatollah, there's no way they can succeed in what they want to do if they're preoccupied with funding terrorism, as if what they want to do is to help the people of Iran, as if what they want to do is to build up the communities around Iran. But what is it that the mullahs want to do? What is it that the Iranian leadership wants to do? What's their mission? What's their goal? What's their goal for the IRGC? What's their goal with respect to Israel? They state it all the time. And to say that they're not going to, or to imply that they're not going to be funding terrorism, or to say that if they do, it's just going to be a little bit, just a little bit. That's so. And compared to Saudi Arabia, I mean, it's a fraction. That's what we're talking about here. And that's going to make Israel, of course, feel a lot better, and Saudi Arabia for that matter. Well, at least Saudi Arabia spends more money. Israel's under no illusion about this deal. This is why Mr. Netanyahu said it's a bad deal. It's a bad deal. Mr. Kerry went on to say, this is from comments he made earlier in the day, yesterday, if we catch them funding terrorism, they're going to have a problem with the United States Congress and other people. That's the strongest statement he said with respect to them funding terrorism. He didn't even say they're going to have a problem with President Obama or with me, John Kerry. He said if we catch them, they're going to have a problem with the U.S. Congress and other people. And that's it. Imagine if the leadership in the United States, if asked a question like that, imagine a leader who spoke up and said, if they use one penny of that to fund terrorism, at the very least, sanctions are going to snap back into place. You can't even imagine, certainly not from this administration, someone making a position or stating a position that emphatic. And then, of course, well, even if they would, there have been some strong statements on foreign policy that have come out of this administration that they've continually backed away from when push comes to shove. In any event, Isaiah 3, boy, weak leadership. He said, finally, we're confident that this will not result in an increase somehow to the threat to any partner or friend in the region. I mean, all he said in that clip I just played for you was that right now, we're 5-6 days on, right now we're not seeing it. We're not seeing any of that money being redirected to Iran. So there's a lot to be confident about here. And furthermore, we're confident that this won't result in an increase in the threat to any partner or friend in the region. And Israel and Saudi Arabia, they just shake their heads. As I say, they're under no illusion. I mean, in that clip I just played, he did admit that at least some of that money will fall into the hands of terror groups. And that's not going to pose a threat to Israel? Israel's surrounded by Hezbollah, Hamas. It does pose a threat to those neighbors. It does pose a threat to America's allies or friends in the region. And as I said yesterday, there's already reports that Iran is preparing to give a significant increase in funding to the IRGC to build up its military so that it can continue to grow in power and strength so it can continue to fund these terrorist operations all around the world. Well, meanwhile in Europe, France also is under no illusion about the threat of radical Islam. This article from the Telegraph, it says that France plans to keep the state of emergency in place until ISIS is crushed. And just having this in place, it gives law enforcement there in France expanded powers so that they can crack down on terror, so that they can get the terrorists. They're going to keep this state of emergency in place to protect the people of France. This article quotes the French Prime Minister, who said, "The time is necessary. We can't always live all the time in a state of emergency. As long as the threat is there, though, we must use all the means until we can get rid of ISIS. In Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, we must eliminate ISIS. It's a total and global war that we're facing with terrorism. With terrorism." Here's someone again who's under no illusion, quite unlike the leaders in the United States. It says the war we're conducting must also be total, global, and ruthless. It has to be ruthless because that's the kind of enemy that France is facing. These are the kinds of leaders that we see in the world today. These are the kinds of movements that we see in the world today, a world that's deceived. A world whose God is Satan the devil, 2 Corinthians 4:4. I also want to refer back to this story I just touched on yesterday, the report here in Britain about Alexander Litvinenko, that Russian spy. He defected to Britain. He was in the Secret Service over there, or the former KGB, and then came here to Britain in 2000, and then was assassinated in 2006. And then this report released yesterday, this British report, has linked this assassination to Vladimir Putin himself. This is Con Coughlin writing. "The damning conclusions reached by the inquiry into the death of Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko serves as yet another reminder of the brutal oppression Russia has experienced since Vladimir Putin came to power more than a decade ago. According to the detailed inquiry published today by Sir Robert Owen, all the evidence suggests Mr. Putin personally approved the outrageous plot to poison Mr. Litvinenko with polonium-210, a form of nuclear material only found at Russian nuclear facilities." As Coughlin brings out, it's a damning report. The evidence, overwhelming. The motive for what amounts to an unprovoked act of nuclear terrorism. I mean, it used this component or this nuclear material. An unprovoked act of nuclear terrorism on the streets of London is that Mr. Putin was angered by the personal antagonism he faced from the former Russian intelligence officer who had sought asylum in Britain after exposing the corruption that is endemic in Putin's Russia. It says the Russian Foreign Ministry has issued its usual lame excuses, claiming the Kremlin had nothing to do with the murder and that the British government is simply politicizing what was essentially a criminal act. But then Russian diplomats have no option but to follow the Kremlin's line if they do not want to suffer a fate similar to that of Mr. Litvinenko and the countless other Russian dissidents who have perished for opposing Mr. Putin's increasingly dictatorial rule. That's just the truth, and there's people in Britain that want to deny this or who want to view Mr. Putin, as Brad McDonald wrote last month, as if he's, you know, he's a little bit of a bully, but he's not really a ruthless tyrant. No, that's Donald Trump. He's the ruthless tyrant. And yet, look at the fruits. Look at the fruits of this man's rule. Look at the countless other Russian dissidents who are now dead. Like Litvinenko. It says one of the more high-profile instances of Mr. Putin's violent treatment of his opponents took place in February last year when Boris Nemtsov was gunned down on a bridge outside the Kremlin for voicing his opposition to Mr. Putin's illegal meddling in Ukraine. That's just the way Putin operates. If you're in Russia, if you're around the Kremlin and you criticize him, or you expose the corruption, that's it. You've got a price on your head. Coughlin says, there are some in Whitehall who continue to argue that we should try to forge an alliance with Mr. Putin and work with him as a partner to resolve some of the world's more intractable issues, such as the Syrian conflict. This is the one that's supposedly solving the conflict in Syria. Coughlin says, but I fail to understand how we can possibly treat a leader who is prepared to indulge in acts of nuclear terrorism as someone, to use Margaret Thatcher's famous remark about former Russian President Mikhail Gorbachev, someone that we can do business with. How can we do business with a leader indulging in acts of terrorism, even on British soil? It happened right here in the UK, in London. A man poisoned to death with nuclear material that's only found at Russian nuclear facilities. That happened right here. And yet this week, British lawmakers were debating whether or not they should ban Donald Trump. Even as Vladimir Putin is literally getting away with murder. Literally. That's the upside-down world we live in. That's the world today, where the ruthless tyrants are on the rise, are gaining power, are building up an arsenal, and picking off enemies one by one. Well, this article, as I just mentioned there, it made me think of Brad McDonald's piece, which is appropriately titled, Fear This Man. It's about Vladimir Putin. Fear this man. He says, in the West, many see Russian President Vladimir Putin more as a schoolyard bully than a ruthless tyrant. He's mischievous and unfriendly, but his behavior, we tell ourselves, is the result of insecurity. If we ignore him, he'll grow out of it. If we ignore him, he'll grow out of this. He'll finally grow up. We just need to welcome him into the international community. The same with Iran. Just welcome them in. They'll come along. That statement by John Kerry, when talking about their goals, the leaders in Iran, their goals, what's really important to them. I mean, he talks about them as if he's talking about a liberal politician in the United States who just wants to go around from state to state and make all these promises that everything's going to get so much better for them and there'll be handouts for everyone. That's not the way the Iranian regime thinks. What are their goals? What is their mission? What is really important to them? What is it that they want to succeed, quote unquote, in the most? Well, as I say, they lay out their mission statement week in and week out for the whole world to hear it. And then you look at what goes on in the Kremlin. What's happened already in Ukraine? Brad McDonald goes into, well, really just how Putin has been manipulating the media, sending out all of his propaganda, causing problems himself behind the scenes, and then swooping in a very public way to present himself as the solution. Brad McDonald writes, but we must not be deceived by Vladimir Putin. There is ample evidence of what this man is about and what he's capable of, more than enough to undermine the naive perspective so many have of him. Many of those who ignore this reality are going to suffer for doing so. See, it's the same with Iran, the king of the south. If we ignore the reality and pretend it's not there and just hope that this is going to end up like a utopia, we'll end up suffering for doing so. He says evil often has a way of seeming attractive and enticing right before it destroys you. That's the way it is. This is not some harmless schoolyard bully. This is a cruel and ruthless tyrant who is intent on targeting his enemies, emasculating the West, as Mr. McDonald said, especially the United States, especially Britain. He is intent on expanding his power, on establishing Russia as the world's leading nation. Just as Iran is intent on establishing that Islamic Republic as the regional powerhouse, the dominant force. It doesn't want Saudi Arabia to take the lead. It doesn't want Israel to even exist. And so it'll redirect a lot of that money right into its military services, right into its terrorist sponsoring organizations. And when you know it, here it's Russia, here it's Vladimir Putin, who's now the supreme authority in the Middle East, or the policeman, at least with respect to Syria. What a change. What a change we've seen. Brad McDonald's article concludes with this: leaders of the United States and Britain appear willfully blind to the nature of Vladimir Putin. He is not the schoolyard bully with a penchant for creating mischief and occasionally stepping over the line. He's much more than a macho man caricature who sells himself as a bastion of conservative traditional values. This man is a killer. He's a killer. He's changing the course of history. And we should wake up and see what's happening in this world. I also thought, of course, about that Prince of Rosh issue of the trumpet from a couple of years ago, which before that, it was talked about on the Key of David program, my father's Key of David program from 2013, Russia in Prophecy. But this article, or that program, they were built around Ezekiel 38, verses 1 and 2, a prophecy. Here in the middle of Ezekiel's book that says, "The word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him." Prophesy against him. That individual, who is it? Well, firstly, you should know this is for the latter days. You can see that in this same chapter, Ezekiel 38, if you look at verses 8 and 16. And then with respect to some of the other names in those two verses, verses 1 and 2, Bible scholars will generally agree that Gog is Russia, and that the land of Magog includes China. So you have this Russia and China alliance, as we've talked about before. Meshek there in verse 2 is another name for Moscow. And then, of course, the most fascinating bit about these two verses is that word chief in verse 2. Chief, that comes from the Hebrew word rosh. The King James there translated that word into an adjective when really it should be a proper noun. Rosh with a capital R. And so really it should read the Prince of Rosh. The Prince of Rosh. That's the leader. Prophesy against him. Ezekiel's command is to prophesy against him. Now, let me again refer you back to that program, November 24th, 2013. My father said on the Key of David, when you study these scriptures alongside current events revealing modern Moscow's imperialist direction, you see that Vladimir Putin could well become the leader of that gigantic army of the East. He's referring there to the 200 million man army mentioned in Revelation 9. But then my father said, I strongly believe Vladimir Putin is going to lead the 200 million man army. Just look at the power he already has. Look at what he's doing. Look at the fruits. Look at what he gets away with. Prophecy rolls along, just like I was saying yesterday. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, our headquarters campus, just north of Oklahoma City. The live stream's available all over the world if you have internet access. KPCG.FM. Send us those emails this weekend so that we can read them live on the air next week. Send those to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
In Luke chapter 1, I think most of you are familiar with this prophecy where it says that Jesus Christ was born to be king. It speaks about his coming rule after his return to this earth, and that he's going to reign forever and ever, and that his kingdom won't ever end. and that he's going to rule from the throne of his father David. God's going to give him that throne. And that throne, as most of you know, exists today. It's on this earth today. If it ceased to exist in Zedekiah's time, the last king of Judah, then that means what is said there in Luke 1. It means that Jesus would return to a non-existent throne, which wouldn't make sense. David's throne does exist on earth today. And when Jesus Christ returns as the glorified King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he'll rule from that throne established by God in King David. Let's look over at 2 Samuel in chapter 7 and see what God has to say about this covenant that he made with King David, this son of Jesse. Let the Bible speak for itself and believe. Verse 8, it says in 2 Samuel 7, "Now therefore, so shall you say unto my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the sheepcote, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people, over Israel. And I was with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies out of your sight, and have made you a great name like the name of the great men that are in the earth." A true rags-to-riches story. God took a lowly shepherd and united all of Israel around a throne that would be established in David. Verse 12, "And when the days be fulfilled and you shall sleep with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, which shall proceed out of your bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. And he shall build a house for my name, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever." That's speaking obviously of Solomon. God saying that David's throne would be set up and established forever. "I'll be his father," verse 14, "and he shall be my son, and if he commit iniquity, I'll chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men." And so if Solomon disobeys, if he stops obeying my commands, I'll punish him, I'll chasten him with the rod of men. But would that mean that the covenant would be canceled? Well, verse 15, "But my mercy shall not depart away from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you." God won't take the throne away, in other words, like he did from Saul. That dynasty ended abruptly. No son of Saul ever sat on the throne that Saul ruled from. But Solomon's dynasty, David's dynasty, through Solomon, through that Davidic line, it would not end. The punishment for disobedience would be chastening at the hands of men, as it says there. In verse 14, verse 16 says, "And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." God can't get any clearer than this. If he said, if they got offline, I'll take care of them. I'll correct them. I'll chasten them. But I'm not going to break my covenant with David. The throne will always be there. The line of kings will always be there. Herbert Armstrong, in his powerful book, U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, he said, "Since God did firmly establish the throne with David and with Solomon, if David's throne ceased from existence, even for the length of one generation, could we say it had been established forever as God here promised?" Of course we couldn't say that. If it just stopped, if it ended in 585 B.C., we'd have to say, well, God is a liar. He didn't keep his word. God did keep his word. God did follow through on this unconditional guarantee. Look at Psalm 89, the book of Psalms, chapter 89. And we'll begin in verse 3. It says, I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have sworn unto David, my servant, your seed will I establish forever and build up your throne to all generations. Here again, this throne would be established forever. And it was built up to all generations, every single one. God even specifically says, all generations. Now, he obviously established the throne, beginning in David with Solomon. And we have a record of those ruling kings in the Old Testament there, right up through King Zedekiah, every single generation. What was it, 19, 20? We have a record of all those generations up till 585 BC. But how could God say all generations if it just meant from David to Zedekiah? What about from Zedekiah to the birth of Christ? What about from Christ's first coming to his second coming? What about all those generations? It says in Luke 1, he's coming to rule from the throne of David. At present, Christ is ruling with God on God's throne in heaven. It says that in Revelation 3 and elsewhere. He's at the right hand of God, but he's coming back, as so many prophecies bring out, to rule from David's throne. And so that throne is somewhere on earth today. It has to be. Or else how could you believe anything God has to say? How could you take him at his word? How could you accept a promise made from God? Verse 28, my mercy will I keep for him forevermore, and my covenant shall stand fast with him, his seed. Speaking of David, his seed also will I make to endure forever, and his throne as the days of heaven. Mr. Armstrong brings out in U.S. and Britain that seed here, it's not referring to general population, the children of Israel, for instance. It's talking about David's sons, specifically. His sons that were to be kings. His dynasty, in other words. It says in verse 30, if the children forsake my law. See, this is very similar to what was said in 2 Samuel. About, well, what if Solomon veers off course? If the children forsake my law and walk not in my judgments, if they break my statutes and keep not my commandments, then will I visit their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. I'll correct them. I'll chasten them. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. Again, some want to say that, well, all these promises, they were conditional. And because of sin, because of rebellion, it all came to a screeching halt in 585 BC. But read on, verse 34, my covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that has gone out of my lips. Once have I sworn by my holiness that I will not lie unto David. His seed shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever as the moon and as a faithful witness in heaven. You can't spiritualize this away. You can't read verses like this and say, well, Jesus came 2,000 years ago in a spiritual kind of way, he rules from that throne. But he certainly didn't come the first time to take over a throne. Not like what's described in Luke 1. Instead, he was crucified. He was crucified. He sacrificed himself for all of mankind and was resurrected. And he ascended to heaven and he's now at the throne of God. But he's coming back to rule. He's coming back to rule from David's throne. How could he take over a throne that hasn't existed for 2,600 years? It's a good question to consider. If you question God, if you doubt God, well, you shouldn't. None of us should. God's word is sure, as I said yesterday, that we have the sure word of prophecy. That throne has existed. And as my father's pointed out before, it's not like it's even that difficult to prove this. You just got to be willing to dig into the United States and Britain and prophecy, and then you're well on your way. You are well on your way. That book, in many ways, is responsible for building up the worldwide Church of God during the 20th century. My father makes that point in Malachi's message. It went around the world to 6 million households. Who knows how many millions and millions of people read it and studied it or were impacted by it. Well, let's go back to 1 Kings this time, 1 Kings 11. If that throne exists, of course, the question that logically follows is, where is it today? Where is that throne today? I think everyone listening, for the most part, knows the answer because we're addressing a listening audience that probably has the United States and Britain in prophecy and has studied it multiple times. But let's just review some of this critical history. You can't cover everything, of course, in just one program. But there's certainly enough here to strengthen our faith, to remind us of God's sure word, of how reliable he is. You can trust God. Verse 6 of 1 Kings 11, and Solomon did evil in the sight of the Eternal, and went not fully after the Eternal as David, his father, did. In other words, he just wasn't as wholehearted. And God, verse 9, was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel. God was upset. He had appeared unto Solomon twice. He gave him all that wisdom. And for a time, I mean, he was dedicated. He was faithful. He gave quite a prayer at the dedication of the temple. But he got involved in a lot of sins later on in life. Verse 11 says, "Wherefore the Lord said to Solomon, for as much as this is done of you, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely rend the kingdom from you, and I will give it to your servant. Notwithstanding, in your days I will not do it for David your father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of your son. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom." Notice this. This is verse 13. "But will give one tribe to the son, your son, for David my servant's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen." So the kingdom was to be rent away. The kingdom, and then the part, the small part, was to remain for David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake. It all revolved around Jerusalem, the city, and the covenant that God made with David, the king. Chapter 12, verse 16, it says, "So when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion have we in David?" So this is after Solomon's death now. "Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, Israel. Now see to your own house, David." So Israel departed to their tents. They were rebelling against the line of David, that throne in Jerusalem, just as God had prophesied, just as God had warned Solomon. Verse 19 says, "So Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day, and it came to pass, when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was come again, and they sent and called him unto the congregation, and made him king over all Israel, and there was none that followed the house of David but the tribe of Judah only." And so there was the small part that was left for David's sake. Benjamin joined on with Judah as well. And then some from the tribe of Levi. But that was the small part. Judah. Benjamin. A little bit of Levi. And of course the city of Jerusalem. And most importantly, the throne of David. But the kingdom was rent away. Most of the tribes broke away to form their own nation. Verse 21, when Rehoboam was come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin and 180,000 chosen men, which were warriors, to fight against the house of Israel, to bring the kingdom again to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. And so here were these two fighting against one another. The house of Israel fighting against the house of Judah. And again, the great majority went and rallied around a new headquarters, Samaria, chose their king, Jeroboam, and you have two nations from that point forward. Now look at Jeremiah chapter 1. This is such an important and critical piece of history that we've got to keep coming back to. I mean, that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, just identifying who the nations of Israel are today, the nations of Ephraim and Manasseh, it unlocks our understanding to all of Bible prophecy. Such an important book. Jeremiah 1:10, "See, I've this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out, to pull down." This is God's commission to Jeremiah, to destroy and to throw down and to build and to plant. And so Jeremiah was right there on the scene as Judah was about to go into captivity. Israel had gone into captivity more than a century earlier. And God was telling Jeremiah, even though in prison, that, look, I'm going to use you to root out, to pull down, and then to plant and to build. He was going to be used. Jeremiah was. He was God's special agent to carry out this mission of moving the throne somewhere else. Now look at Jeremiah 33 and verse 3. Again, Jeremiah was imprisoned in Jerusalem at the time of this book, at the time it was being written. And the armies of Babylon were taking Jews captive. And it looked like the throne of David was about to cease to exist forever. Jeremiah 33 and verse 3, "Call unto me, and I will answer you, and show you great and mighty things, which you know not. For thus says the Eternal, the God of Israel, concerning the houses of this city, and concerning the houses of the kings of Judah, which are thrown down by the mounts and by the sword." Jeremiah was right there, right in the midst of the destruction, right as the king's houses in Jerusalem were being destroyed, right as the throne of David was about to be removed. But he, as I say, was God's special agent for preserving that kingly line, even though Zedekiah's sons were killed. A princess survived. This also is in the book of Jeremiah. God's reassuring him here in chapter 33 that rule, that Davidic line, it would continue. Don't worry. Don't worry. You're going to have a hand in making sure that it continues. Jesus Christ is going to be sitting on an existing throne. Notice verse 14, "Behold, the days come." Here's a prophecy. Here's a millennial passage. God's offering his prophet quite a lot of encouragement. There was a time, and this is reflected in the Psalms, that Jeremiah was greatly discouraged, wondering, well, how is this promise of God going to work out? Judah's about to be destroyed. Well, look at what God gave to him. Look at this revelation. Verse 14, "Behold, the days come, says the Eternal, that I'll perform that good thing which I have promised unto the house of Israel and to the house of Judah," both houses. There were two nations, remember, after the days of Solomon ended. They split into two nations. Most went north. Most of them, they were Israel. Then the southern kingdom, Judah, included that little tribe of Judah, Benjamin, and so on. But here is a prophecy when these two will once again rally around one throne Verse 15, in those days and at that time will I cause the branch of righteousness to grow up unto David. And he shall execute judgment and righteousness in the land. Again, it's speaking of Christ coming as ruler, as King of kings and Lord of lords, when he's going to rule from David's throne. And in those days shall Judah be saved, verse 16, and Jerusalem shall dwell safely. And this is the name wherewith he shall be called, the Lord our righteousness. The prophesied millennial reign of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. Notice verse 17. It says, for thus says the Eternal, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. Here is Jeremiah, writing more than a century after Israel had gone into captivity. And Judah is about to be uprooted and overturned. And yet this verse says, David shall never at any time through all generations lack a man or a descendant who would remain on that throne, a continuous line. He'll never lack a man. He'll never want a man. That's the meaning. Now, what's amazing there is it says to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel, because from David, well, at least after Solomon died and the 12 tribes split into two nations, from Rehoboam on all the way through to Zedekiah, that Davidic king ruled over Judah, the house of Judah in Jerusalem. But notice here, God encouraging Jeremiah says, David shall never lack a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. And so you get back to this commission to root out, to destroy, and then to go over and to plant and build. Jeremiah had a hand in transferring that throne from the house of Judah to the house of Israel. Verse 20, it says, thus says the Eternal, if you can break my covenant of the day and my covenant of the night, and that there should not be day and night in their season, then may also my covenant be broken with David my servant, that you should not have a son to reign upon his throne. Well, if you can break those covenants, then you can break mine. But you can't, can you? Neither can my word be broken. Verse 24 says, consider you not what this people have spoken, saying two families which the Lord has chosen, he has even cast them off. Thus they have despised my people, that they should no more, that they should be no more a nation before them. Don't consider what people say about these two families, the Jews scattered about among many, or that the 10 tribes have been taken into captivity and supposedly lost, disappeared. And that the throne of David was crushed and it ended in 585 BC. Don't consider what people say. What does God say? Verse 25, thus says the Eternal, if my covenant be not with day and night, and if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth, then will I cast away the seed of Jacob and David my servant, so that I will not take any of his seed to be the rulers over the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's quite a conclusion to that chapter. God saying that unless you can stop the earth from spinning on its axis, or unless you can remove the sun and the moon from heaven, God says you can't prevent him from keeping that covenant, from maintaining that continuous line through all generations forever and ever. If you have a copy of U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, that'd be an excellent study when you have some time to devote to it. We've been plugging quite a lot of literature. Finish Malachi's message first, and then maybe you can tear into U.S. and Britain as well. Well, we come to the end of another fruitful and productive week. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial later today, Oklahoma time. That'd be 4 p.m., I believe. Trumpet Hour. Don't forget about that. later on today or through this weekend if you listen to the podcast. Send us your emails, td@kpcg.fm, and hopefully we can get to some of those on a broadcast next week. Thank you for joining us today, as always, and we'll talk to you again next week.